From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made last January in what now looks like it was a clear warning for Democrats and one that they might have missed. Gallup reported that the number of Americans who identify as political independents reached an all-time high, 43%. Most of the shift toward political independence has come at the expense of Democrats. Now, to be fair, the Republican Party brand has been rough for decades. The last time there were more Republicans than Democrats in this country was 2002, according to Gallup. That was shortly after 9/11. And since then, Democrats have outpaced Republicans by anywhere from 3 to 10 points nationwide. That advantage is gone now. Republicans and Democrats are tied at just 27%. That is the lowest number ever in recorded polling for Democrats. Independents are surging. But look closer. Gallup also asks independents which way they lean. And for just the third time since 1990, there are more Republican leaners than Democratic leaners. The leading bloc is now independents, who tend to describe themselves as political moderates. They want less extremism, more cooperation. Small C conservatives have a plurality in this country. And so we wondered, what lessons do they want both parties to learn from the recent elections? Gallup concluded its polling in January with this, quote, "In what is expected to be a close election contest in November, it is critical for each party, but especially Democrats, to nominate a candidate who can appeal to independent voters," end quote. And what is clear now is that Democrats did not do that nearly enough. Let's talk to a couple of people who can help us understand which way kind of that political center looks these days. John Love is the president of the Bob Johnson Auto Group. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Nice to have you here. John Kalia is an executive coach and author. His book, The Awakening of Artemis, reached number 6 on Amazon's sci-fi adventure bestseller list. Welcome back to the program. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much, Evan.
John, so John Kalia, let's just start with a political moderate, I guess. How do you self-identify these days?
That's an interesting term. I have a hard time. I even have a hard time with conservative because it tends to mean so many different things to so many different people. It was popular, I think, a couple of decades ago for a lot of middle-class people, moderates, to describe themselves as fiscally conservative and socially liberal. That still, I think, kind of appeals to me. I used to also say I was a Rockefeller Republican like Bill Clinton. And frankly, I'm wherever Bill Clinton was is kind of where I still am.
That's interesting. Yeah. So not a Reagan Republican.
No, I wouldn't say that. I admire Reagan more now than I did in the 80s.
When's the last time you voted for the winner of a presidential election?
1996.
96.
Yes.
Okay.
So that was Clinton's
second term. Some math here. I'm like, who did John vote for all these years?
Well, it's easy to say that. So you might conclude that I voted for Harris this time, right? But I didn't. These last three election cycles, I kind of sat out by, in 16 and 20, I voted for the Libertarian candidate. This year, when my wife went to the polls a few days before me, she came back and said, there's no third party candidates on the ballot. And I did a little research and learned that that was a parting gift from Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah.
And so I wrote in Nikki Haley. And then later learned that there were only certain candidates who were approved as write-in votes, and therefore my Nikki Haley vote was invalid.
It was thrown out.
Yes.
So you're like a null voter this year.
Yes, I am.
Now, John Kalia is right. Andrew Cuomo and his administration made it very difficult to do a lot of things on the ballot. That was by design.
Right.
Made it very, very difficult for so-called
I think it got burned by Cynthia Nixon.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. John Love, how do you self-identify these days?
Well, I use the term as centrist more than anything else. My goal when I'm looking at candidates is not which party they represent. In fact, if you looked at my ballot slip, I would vote both sides. I'm not up and down the line Republican, although I'm registered as one. My goal is to live in a community in which we achieve our goals, which is to just have a comfortable life, a safe life, a good work-life balance, and whatever candidate's going to give me most of that is where my vote's going to go.
When's the last time you were excited and optimistic about whoever you were voting for president?
Believe it or not, I was excited about Barack Obama. And I'm a Republican.
In 8 or 12?
In 8.
In 8, okay.
In 8. Because I thought that it was a fresh change that would engage more voters. It would bring new voters to the polls because of his youth, because of his demographic. And I really believe that if there was ever a chance to revitalize America for all, that was the chance.
So since then, it's been like, hey, I'm not going to love either choice here. I'm going to make a choice, but these don't necessarily represent exactly where I want to be. Is that fair?
Very fair.
Okay. So I'm going to ask, I'll ask you first, John Love. I'll ask both of you. What do you want Democrats, let's start with Democrats, to learn from the results of this election?
I think the answer is twofold. Number one, they could have won this election, but it seems that what we lacked was any questions to Harris was, what do you think about the economy? The answer is Trump is bad. How about immigration? Trump is bad. How about just the cost of goods? Trump is bad. She didn't have a platform that really talked about what she would do differently. In fact, when she was asked what she would do differently than her predecessor, nothing.
She said on The View, I can't think of anything.
And she was asked twice, and she couldn't think of anything, which I'm sure she could think of a lot of things. But that was indicative of the disconnect, in my opinion, with what we need in this country.
So let me just probe that a little bit more. 5 years ago, when Kamala Harris, in the fall of 2019, was one of the leading Democratic contenders, and then didn't even make it to Iowa. She was out of the race before Iowa. She ran a campaign that adopted a number of much more extreme positions than this time. Her campaign said, essentially, her campaign tried not to even really talk about that. They adopted what I think strategists would call a more moderate position on a number of issues. But it sounds to me like your observation was, by not actually articulating if you've changed and why, it's hard to see what you actually do stand for. Is that right?
I agree. And I would disagree that they adopted a more moderate position. They portrayed it, but they never came out in opposition of their prior position. And so I think that that was smoke and mirrors more than anything else.
Okay. Well, let's ask the other John in the room. What do you want Democrats to learn from this election?
Well, I'd have to say, first of all, you predicted that John and I would agree on a lot of things, and I agree with a lot of what he said.
Make sure you get that mic a little closer to you, John.
Okay.
C.
Sorry.
There you go. Yep.
I would guess that I'd like them to learn that capitalism and the free market is the driver of our prosperity, that government interference in those markets can be damaging, although certainly we need to be regulated, that everything that we want to do as a country, and we can debate what those things might be, everything we want to do as a country relies upon that prosperity. So, and I agree with John's observation that there were a lot of pronouncements that then weren't backed up in a way that was convincing. For me, mostly it was the pronouncement that, quote, I am a capitalist, and then a follow-up which said, I want government to be a partner with business, which are two antithetical statements. And then further blaming business for inflation rather than looking in the mirror and saying, we made some mistakes, and here's how I would correct them. And even going further to say that she would enact policies that would deal with price gouging. So, you know, I look across the board, and what I see is just unsound economics, weak foreign policy, woke social policies, and altogether, an extreme view of how the nation's politics should affect the citizenry that I really just can't get behind.
Where is the weak part of the foreign policy that the Democrats carried this time to you?
Well, I believe that the way in which the Afghanistan pullout was conducted was a signal to our foreign adversaries. I believe that we as a nation take our national security for granted, like we take our prosperity for granted. And that what people don't understand is that Europe and the Pacific Ocean, for example, are buffer zones for us that protect us from attacks by those who would wish to harm us. And therefore, we should support Ukraine and Israel in a way that we haven't supported them. And by that, what I mean is Biden in particular said we support you, but then put restrictions on arms that we would give Ukraine, which, by the way, just yesterday.
Just changed, yeah.
He just changed his position on that.
Yeah.
I also believe that we have a historic opportunity to neutralize Iran for a generation if we cut Israel loose, allow them to destroy Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthi rebels, and reimpose the sanctions that the Trump administration had, that we have the opportunity to bankrupt them. And instead, what Biden did was ask them to come back to the negotiating table. Their response was, well, remove the sanctions and we'll think about it. And therefore, he dumped $100 billion back into their economy, which revived them. And now they're a significant and existential threat to our allies and to us.
On the side of the economy, I saw John nodding at a couple points over there. Your co-panelist here is not satisfied and wants Democrats to learn hard lessons on how the political middle views the economy. You agree with that?
I totally agree with it. I just recently went shopping with my wife for the first time, and she was laughing at me because I was shocked at how expensive bread and milk really was. I thought you could buy a loaf of bread for a dollar still. Shows you how long.
A dollar.
So, yes, she laughed too. Anyways, I think that there's a definite disconnect. And, you know, I read something recently, and it was in The Guardian, and it says that the Harris campaign was flawless because they had every prominent celebrity voice on their side. It said that the vice president ran a campaign that was in both style and substance like today's Democratic Party as a whole, which was the professional class. I would trade professional with the elitist class. Hollywood was certainly on her side. She had 10 concerts, we'll call them that, of over $2 million a crack to put them on, to bring Beyonce, J-Lo, et cetera, et cetera. That does nothing for our economy. If you have to bring in celebrities to fill a stadium to portray that you have the side of the voter, there's something wrong with your campaign. And that shows the disconnect between the people on the street, the man and woman on the street, and how they're struggling to survive.
So let me ask you both a little bit more about inflation, and then we'll turn and ask our guests, a couple of Johns who are John Love, John Kalia with us, talking about how they view, as political centrists, how they view this election and what lessons they want, really all political leaders, to learn from it. You both talked about the economy, you talked about inflation. And I am amenable to the idea that this was going to be a hard election for any incumbent. What we saw around the world this year was incumbents got crushed. It is true that the United States has had inflation. It didn't peak as high, and it went down faster than almost everybody else. It's still a huge issue. And it's easy to tell people, well, the economist that I talked to said we're handling inflation pretty well. When you go to the grocery store, and even you are shocked, John Love.
That's right.
So I get it. I do get that. I want to ask both of you, how do you contextualize the challenge of inflation and say, do we give credit to this team for doing better than most? Or do we say, no, it should never have been this bad. And even if you outpaced most other countries, we're still hurting and you need to pay a price as a result. What's realistic and what kind of policy do you want to see that's different?
Well, I think no matter what you did, it wasn't good enough when the average household can't afford to put a reasonable meal on the table. It wasn't good enough. So you failed either way. And when you wrap business in regulations to the point of a stranglehold and it makes it difficult to hire more people because of just the cost of doing business, that puts fewer jobs out there. And we can say that the job market is better than it's been. But I think if you talk to the people on the street, it probably isn't. There's a lot of low-paying jobs or gig economy.
Tell me a little bit more about that, because we do see the unemployment rate down. We see stock market all-time highs. And the Biden administration spent a lot of this year trying to convince people the economy is pretty darn good here.
Sure.
By a lot of metrics. And you're saying what really mattered most, it wasn't meeting that standard.
That's correct, because the jobs that were created were low-paying, low-wage jobs, which when you put that against inflation is not a good offset to that. You have a lot of people working in the gig economy that have stopped looking for W-2 work, which makes it look like there's fewer people out there looking for work, but they're working in Uber and DoorDash and things like that. And so we've really become a country, a society of truly paycheck to paycheck, but almost day to day in our earnings, and you put that against how expensive it is to live, it just doesn't work well. And when we talk about whether it's Democrat or Republicans, the elite class in our country, the billionaires, millionaires, et cetera, their disconnect from what's happening in our neighborhoods, whether it be the cost of living, crime, et cetera, they're just out of reality.
On inflation, what would you want to see whoever is in power do different? What could have prevented some of what we have dealt with here?
Well, the simple answer to that would be to refer to Larry Summers and Jason Furman, both of whom worked in the Obama administration, and both of whom are leading economists at Harvard. The ARP, the American Rescue Plan, which is a $1.9 trillion, what would you call it?
Spending package?
A spending package, I was going to say, use a different word, but let's stick with spending package.
Are you thinking more like hemorrhaging?
No, let me just put it in context, okay? We were just coming out of the pandemic.
Yeah.
We had already pumped $5 trillion into the economy in order to preserve, sort of create a floor under the economic damage that was done during the pandemic. The money that had been passed in December of 2020, right, with bipartisan votes signed off by Trump, had not yet made its way into the economy. There were already concerns that it would be inflationary. Furman and Summers both said, don't do it. That we have, as an economy, we have reached the capacity that we can absorb. And if you pass this $1.9 trillion bill, you'll exceed that capacity, and that will be inflationary. And that was totally ignored. So the answer to your question, I think, is, you know, we can't roll the clock back. The question now is, what do we do going forward? Well, now we have institutionalized $2 trillion annual deficits. When we talk about how well the economy is doing, right, anybody who knows what the formula for GDP is knows that government spending is a significant part of it. So let's take that increase of the deficit out of the GDP numbers, and then let's look at what that growth looks like. The other comment I would make is that there's an awful lot of people that make this statement, I think you just did, that we are doing better than all the other industrialized economies.
Just
in the world.
The metrics that the economists who are smarter than me share, that's what I see.
Okay.
Doesn't mean that we're doing great. It means others are doing worse.
Well, yeah. And I would say that the general long-term direction of the Democratic Party is kind of in line with what Bernie Sanders ran on in 2016. Let's be more like Europe. Well, Europe's economy was not sustainable. We could see that in 2008, you could see it in 2016, and you can see it now. I don't think that's a model we should be pursuing.
So no extra credit, even if we performed better than a lot of other countries on inflation, because as you see it, there were choices that were made, and they were the wrong choices, and they were inflationary, and people suffered as a result.
That's a fair summary.
Okay. We're talking to John Kalia, who's an executive coach and an author, John Love, president of the Bob Johnson Auto Group, at a time when independents are the biggest voting bloc in the country right now, the highest number Gallup has ever recorded, 43% of Americans self-identifies as independent. Republicans have held an identification advantage for 20-plus years now. That's gone. I'm sorry, Democrats had that advantage for 20-plus years. It's gone. Both Democrats and Republicans are about 27%. But a plurality really is in that small-C conservative lean-right category now. And so we're talking about lessons from this. So they've talked about where they – and we'll get back to how they see some of the political left. We haven't covered all that ground yet. But I do want to talk about how they want the Republican Party in its current iteration – to understand lessons from this election. And John Kalia, you talked about foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Now, you want to see more of a green light to Israel, which they will get on almost certainly from the Trump administration. Ukraine's a totally different deal.
Mm-hmm.
And Ukraine is very, very concerned about what is coming for them.
Right.
And European allies are concerned that the NATO is going to fall apart. So what do you want? Let's start with foreign policy. What do you want Republicans to learn from this election?
I'm not sure I can answer the question about what they should learn.
They feel like they're spiking the ball in the end zone here.
That's right.
So maybe the better question is, what are you concerned about, and what do you like what you see on the foreign policy side?
Well, I'm very concerned about Trump's entire approach to foreign policy, which is to eschew alliances in favor of one-to-one relationships. I don't know how much of his bluster about NATO is just sort of creating a straw man in order to motivate them to do something to defend themselves. I certainly am a longtime supporter of NATO and believe that we should be working to create a similar kind of alliance in the Western Pacific in order to counter China's moves. Certainly their intention, their stated intention, to make a move on Taiwan by 2027. So I don't see, I'm a former Florida resident. I'm not a great admirer of Marco Rubio. And frankly, when you sort of look at the landscape.
Incoming Secretary of State, likely.
Right.
Yeah.
If you look at the landscape, he's one of the safer choices. I mean, there are a number of red flags associated with the choices that he's made for his cabinet. So I'm not encouraged by that. I wasn't encouraged by the way he conducted himself in his first term. It'd be easy for me to say, just listen to Nikki Haley. I guess that's the...
But you really want Nikki Haley to be president.
Nobody,
I have to tell you.
Yeah,
well, I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, it's not. And I don't think we're going to go back to that.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, there's a couple of things I think will happen in the next decade and probably sooner. One is I think that there will be a next generation leader that will figure out the language problem. And by that, what I mean is that the urban poor and the rural poor have the same needs, but they speak as though they were at war with one another, right? So somebody who can figure out how to talk to both of those constituencies, I think, will then be the populist leader of the future.
For now, that's trending right in a way that Democrats never could have imagined. We saw the racial divide in this country narrow in this election,
right?
And it's almost it's not entirely. I don't want to minimize. I understand there are still racial divides. But the class divide, the educational divide, and to some extent gender, is where the divides widened, whereas a racial divide, ethnic divides, got narrower. It's more on class lines, to your point there.
Well,
and that doesn't sound like that doesn't surprise you.
It doesn't surprise me. You know,
it surprised the Democrats.
Well, but you see, I think what's happened is that the center has moved. Okay? So in 96, when I voted for Bill Clinton, I was left of center. My attitudes and approaches, my political beliefs, haven't really changed that much since then.
So welfare reform, something a little bit more aggressive on policing and criminal justice.
Yes. Right? I mean, we haven't even gotten to a discussion of the border and what all that's about. But you know, if you look at it, right, if it's easy for me to say this, it might be wrong. I can't analyze myself too much. But if I've stayed in the middle, if I've stayed in the same spot, and I went from being left of center to right of center, it's the middle, it's the center that's moved. The center has moved left. Now, you could almost say that's generational. In 96, the World War II generation was still alive and voting, and now they're not. What you have now is millennials who are a major force, political force, and they're voting. So they're younger, and they have more liberal views, and my views are more out of fashion in a lot of ways, and I recognize that. But that's why I'm hopeful.
I think that political center, clearly based on this election, is moving back to the right. I mean, we'll see. But one other quick follow-up with you, John, before I turn to John Love. Would you say that a lesson you hope the Republicans don't learn is that alliances aren't that important and strong individual, empowered individuals matter more?
I think what I hope is that this romance with all things Trump will fade. If it doesn't happen in the next 2 years, it'll certainly happen in the second half, in the lame duck session, the lame duck portion of his term. What I really hope is that we can have rational players on both sides of the aisle working to solve some of the nation's biggest problems. And I'll give you an example of where I'm very critical of Trump, right? There's a guy named Jim Lankford, who's a senator from Oklahoma, who marshaled the forces of both sides of the Senate in order to create an immigration reform bill.
About a year ago,
Yeah. And it passed the Senate. It was likely to pass the House with bipartisan support. Trump said he didn't like it. Now, he never said why he didn't like it. My belief is he didn't like it because he didn't want to give Biden a win.
That's what Mitt Romney said, yeah.
Yeah. So, to me, that's indicative of how, and I think this is true of many players on both sides of the aisle, people are more worried about victory at elections, are more worried about the success of their party than they are about the country.
All right, John Love, what are the lessons you do think are valuable for a pretty joyous Republican Party, and what do you think would be the wrong message for them to take forward?
So they shouldn't be spiking the ball too much. There's a lot of work to do, and their success is yet to be seen. But I think one of the clear things, and I saw it last night on TV, is they somewhat have lightning in a bottle with all demographics and all ages, because there's this movement right now that it's almost cool to be Trump, which sounds really scary to say.
And let me just interrupt, John, and say, I was watching the United States-Jamaica international soccer game last night. Christian Pulisic, one of the great American players of this generation, scored, and he went straight to the corner flag, and he did the Trump dance. And Alexi Lalas, a longtime U.S. soccer player, now an analyst and a big Trump supporter, said, basically, suck it up, Democrats. It's cool to like Trump if you're an athlete now. The zeitgeist is moving.
And it's not just athletes. You see it on college campuses, which by far and away are very liberal-leaning, but you're seeing the same thing where people are coming out and saying, it's a new day, and there's this renewed energy. And I think that the difference is what Trump brought, whether he executes or not, and his cabinet executes or not, is it's time to look at America and remember that it's a majority-rule democracy. We can't forget about the minority agenda, if you will. I don't mean race minority, but the minority agenda, meaning the really far left and really far right. Let's ignore the right for a minute, the really far left. But we became too focused on the exception, not the rule, in our country, in a lot of people's minds, whether it's young, college age, or retirees, or anything in the middle. We have the opportunity to fix some wrongs, but we really have an opportunity to focus on the middle class, which is something that the Democrats have not done in a while, and the Republicans have not done. We have an opportunity to identify it and help those that are not middle class become middle class through job creation, through affordable living, through addressing immigration, addressing the foreign trade that's coming in. We'll never see a 20% tariff, I don't believe, but there should be something. We should not let China have a free rein on bringing goods into this country or other countries. So I think it's a chance to right some wrongs from both sides. I don't have a lot of faith that Trump's going to do it, but I hope he surrounds himself with intelligent people.
When it comes to tariffs, you're the president of the Bob Johnson Auto Group. You understand the supply chains, costs of products, et cetera. What does the word tariff mean to you, and what do you think Americans understand? I'm not trying to talk down to any listener. I had to go back to my high school or college educational days during this presidential campaign and went, I really want to understand tariffs again, because tariffs are coming back strong here. What do they mean to you?
Sure. So tariffs, of course, by simplest definition, is higher prices for goods coming in, which means higher prices at our home, right? But what we have to accept is that manufacturing companies still have to be competitive in the U.S. So they can only raise prices to absorb tariffs so much. A lot of times tariffs come out of profitability, not passed on to consumers, which is the narrative that's been sold, is that consumers will pay more. They will, but not dollar for dollar more. The hope is that the offset of tariffs, moderate tariffs, would be that manufacturing will increase in the U.S., not new brick and mortar, but there are companies here today that are building components and competing with overseas subpar components based on cost of goods. That tariff may equalize that. Tariffs may equalize that. So we could change the tide pretty quickly as far as manufacturing. And that's an area, again, that we have to focus on, not the elite, but the everyday person, more manufacturing jobs, more trades jobs. And all of that, I think, does come with a reasonable adjustment to how we look at imported goods.
NPR reported that in the first Trump administration, tariffs on solar panels did put some pressure to see more domestic manufacturing of solar panels. That's what they're designed to do. So you're saying, yeah, prices may go up, not for dollar, might see some modest increases. If they're effective, we'll also see more jobs and more manufacturing here. So is the right message, use this tool wisely, don't be afraid to use it. The wrong message, 60% tariffs across the board. Let's go crazy. Like some of the rhetoric we heard in the campaign, you're hoping is just rhetoric.
That's just fodder. It's not going to happen. It just can't happen. There's too many checks and balances for that. But there should be some equalization so that our American jobs, American companies can compete on an equal playing field.
All right. So in our remaining time here with John Love and John Kalia, who are talking to us as from the position of political centrists who sometimes have felt homeless politically, but you know, are talking about how they view this current election and the state of American politics. We're going to ask them soon enough here, what do you fear most about how you would perceive an extreme left, and what do you fear most about how you would perceive an extreme right? But before we get there, a bonus question for both of you. A lot of talk about the proposed cabinet. You talked about Marco Rubio. What do you like and what do you not see from a proposed cabinet so far, John Love?
Sure. So I'll step out of the cabinet and say that DOGE has me very excited.
DOGE is the Department of Government Efficiency.
Exactly.
Do you mean DogeCoin?
No, I mean this new department, although okay. You know, Musk confuses me a bit. But we have so much bloat in the federal government at all levels. It's just absolutely criminal. Any focus that we can put on it, just anybody paying attention, will result in a reduction in expenditures there. And that, when you're talking about multi-trillion dollar budgets, will absolutely drive to the bottom line and help improve our economy. That is a big thing. I'm in a little different position with Rubio than my counterpart here, but I think that we need somebody with a firm hand that sends the right message across the world that we're not going to tolerate the treatment and the things that are happening in Ukraine, in Israel. We need to let people know that we mean business. We're not soft-handing this anymore.
By the way, we'll talk DOGE on a separate day. It's an interesting idea. The joke kind of writes itself that we're going to create this new Department of Government Efficiency, but we needed two people to run it. Can't have one.
Sure.
Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. Right. Now it just looks like patronage jobs.
Sure, it does. But how many other positions do we have in our government that have multiple people? How many people even in county government and city governments around the country?
So you like DOGE, you like Rubio. Is anything that concerns you in the cabinet?
Yeah, his attempted pick for attorney general. I think that
you
was
don't just think Matt Gaetz is...
He's got no shot. I think that was a move to prevent the current administration from getting somebody in. Gaetz has no shot. He gets to keep his retirement in the end. He doesn't get confirmed. And Trump gets to pick the next AG. Gaetz is just a blocker.
If he's confirmed, do you think that would be the disaster that people talk about? Is it a moral disaster?
I believe it's a disaster at any level, any optic, but I don't see it happening.
Okay. John Kalia, what do you like, what do you not like from the cabinet?
I would say that what I might like is the pick for Secretary of Treasury, which hasn't been announced yet, but what I know about the players that are in contention— to me, they sound like they know what they're talking about. It's one of the few areas in which I think Trump might nominate a strong person rather than a weak person. I really think what he's done here is pick a weak cabinet across the board. I agree with John's.
Who are loyal to him.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, there were two books that were written by members of his who participated in the first administration. One was Nikki Haley. I'm sorry to mention that name again.
It's okay.
And the other I read just recently was from H.R. McMaster, who was his first...
National Security Advisor?
National Security Advisor, right? And both said the same thing. Tillerson and Kelly, who were respectively state and defense, joined the administration to counter Trump's worst instincts, created a lot of infighting. They may have been right, they may have been wrong, but in any event, they weren't loyal to Trump. And loyalty is a big word for him. So I think what he's done is pick weak players who will do his bidding, as opposed to strong players who will expand his thinking and perhaps lead to better solutions. I think that's true of Hegseth at defense. I think it's certainly true of Gaetz. And I agree with John's observation. I think Gaetz might be a straw man. Maybe he has some other lunatic that he wants to put in there. And once Gaetz get run off, the other lunatic will look more reasonable. I don't know. But I wouldn't put it past him.
Okay. Now, let me read an email from Charles, who writes, Charles says, I'd actually kind of prefer it if one of the two parties didn't learn anything from this past election. Charles is saying he hopes Democrats keep losing. Let me crack the code there. Charles is very happy with these election results, and he hopes the Democrats don't learn anything. So when it comes to extremes, when you think of an extreme left, mm-hmm. what do you fear the most, John?
I don't know if I'd use the word fear. I would say that I would just make a couple of observations. One is that let's just take the border and immigration. The extreme left position is that these are refugees and that we should give them the benefits of citizenship and protect them. And anybody who disagrees with them is immoral or a racist. We've also been treated to the aggrandizement of the 1619 Project. And we've been preached to the extent that we are supposed to believe that nothing has changed in the last 400 years, in spite of the fact that everybody knows that a lot has changed and a lot has improved for racial minorities and for women over the last 50 years. Are we perfect? No. Another idea is that the school systems should be helping children who declare themselves to be transgender without the participation or the consent of parents. All of these ideas are just antithetical to 80% or more of the population. And that's why I think they undermine their own credibility with us. So I sort of look at it and, sort of under the umbrella of the feeling I get is that the extreme left is saying, we're smarter than you, we have better values than you, you're immoral, you're racist if you disagree with us. We want to tell you how to live, what to believe, and impose that on you. I would make the same criticism of the extreme right, by the way.
What way?
Well, the extreme right, are the people that marched on the Capitol on January 6th. I would give them no quarter. But the truth is, right, even those who are very conservative, who, live in the deep South and are enculturated that way, who may or may not be racist, most of them didn't march on the Capitol on January 6th, right? Most of us know what racism really looks like because, I don't know about my colleague here, but I would say this. I have sat in the room and heard it when I was in business, before I retired from business, right? And the need to correct it, right, is sometimes lost on people. So it takes some courage and some leadership, right? So I know that there remains bigotry in the workplace and so on and so forth. But at the same time, 50% of African Americans are in the top three quintiles. In other words, they're middle class. And they participate in the economy, and they get a good education, and we all know that progress has been made. So the tendency for language to become extreme, and for accusations to be made without any nuance, is something that I think most of us find offensive.
I'm going to try to sum it up. Tell me if this is correct. On the extreme left, you point to 1619, among other initiatives, as, in your view, peddling the idea that we're barely any better, if at all. We're the same sort of damnable place without progress. On the extreme right, it's this idea that everything is fixed and it's fine and there are no problems. And, shut up about race, et cetera. And you hold both views?
I would make a stronger statement about the extreme right. I think the extreme right are declare themselves to be nationalists, which is, to me, is code for Nazi. And would take up arms if they thought they had the opportunity to make changes that they thought were appropriate.
Were you worried about what would happen if Harris had won the election?
Yes.
You were worried about that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was.
All right. John Love, when you think
can,
about—
Can I just make one more comment?
Yeah, go ahead, John. Yeah.
I'm sorry. All this, to me, falls under the umbrella of criticizing and naming institutions and people as though nothing ever goes right. And we all walk around every day and most everything is right. We live in safe neighborhoods. We have good jobs. We can bring up our children. and they get a good education. We can save and help them get into college. Most of those things work well. And that doesn't mean that everything is right. But in order to fix what's wrong with America, we must first acknowledge what's right with America.
We're not on the verge of collapse, in other words.
Absolutely not.
Okay. John Love, when you think the term extreme left, extreme right, what comes to mind? What concerns you?
So what comes to mind is that, and it feels more so with the extreme left, that they have the loudest voice and get the most audience. The cameras go to the extreme left. A rally of five people is a mass protest in a city of a million people. It's the extreme outliers that seem to make the TV screen, the internet, and that if you listen to them, our country is a terrible place. We should be ashamed of who we are. We should be ashamed of where we live, what we do for a living, how our children are raised, and how they're educated. And that's not reality. And I think we saw that in this election cycle where the majority of Americans, 5 million more, voted for one person than the other, I think was the gap, that it's okay to be proud of our country, recognizing that there are improvements that need to be made. There are great disparities between different socioeconomic classes, but we're still darn good. And I've said this to my children who are all of voting age. With all of our flaws, every day there's more people trying to enter America than there are trying to leave America. Mm-hmm. That means something. And we have to build on that. And I think that's what happened in this election cycle.
And on the right, what concerns you? Extreme right. What comes to mind?
Sure. So neo-Nazism, extreme racism, and actually people that are anti-government. The extreme right would love nothing more than to overthrow the government. For the most part, no matter who is at the top of the ticket, who's sitting in the White House.
Is that what do you think you saw on January 6th?
Absolutely. Yeah. We saw it in Charleston. We saw it on January 6th.
Or Charlottesville.
Charlottesville, sorry.
Yeah.
My apologies. And that, too, gets, in some cases, too much audience, and in others, not enough. I don't know that we're as aware as we should be of just how dangerous the extreme right is. But that's not who we are as a party, as Republicans or Democrats. We're not extreme left or extreme right.
I think part of what kind of drives some of the left crazy is they will see, for example, Trump will change the colors of his hat to black and gold. And those are colors associated with the Proud Boys. And the left is convinced he's winking at them. Or he'll be on Newsmax in an interview. And the MyPillow guy will put an ad on the screen for $14.88, which 1488 has code in some extreme right-wing militia groups. And people are convinced that's intentional. And I'm not convinced it's not at least trolling. You know, like that I don't know that Trump is I'm not saying he's a Proud Boy. But I'm not convinced that he's not just trolling the left on purpose, knowing that it's going to tweak them. And I don't know if that's good leadership either. I mean, what do you see?
I agree. But the reality of that is, until you told me about the black and gold hat, I don't know about it. So it's nothing until we make it something. And that's the problem, I think, on the far right and far left, is that we create a platform and an audience that otherwise would just be some crazies in the woods. And that adds validation to it. And then you get more people sitting there going, you know, gee, I ought to look into that. Maybe I feel that way as well. I'm not saying we should censor it. But there's such a hunger in this country for exposing anything that will gin us up, that will get us angry and want us to disagree with each other. And we have to somehow step back from that. And Trump is not the fix, by the way. But guess what? I don't think Harris was either, because her fight is going to continue.
Well, so let me ask both of you then, because this is where, you know, Democrats listening who want to win voters like you guys and thought they had put together a kind of campaign that could. Here's what they have been saying since the election. That in 2016, Hillary Clinton talked about, I'm with her. Those were the signs. She talked about breaking the glass ceiling. She talked about the historic nature of a woman president all the time. And Kamala Harris barely mentioned it, really didn't, and intentionally didn't do it. Didn't talk about her race, didn't talk about her gender, didn't talk about a glass ceiling, was advised that didn't work. And people know, all people are smart enough to realize this would be historic. You don't have to hit people with it. You got to earn their vote otherwise. And she ran a campaign that largely eschewed the identity that I think Hillary Clinton ran on. And I think some Democrats thought, well, why was that not like we learned that lesson? Like we didn't go hard on identity. She intentionally didn't do that. When she was asked by Bret Baier, you know, all these millions of Americans are going to vote for Trump. Like, do you think they're deplorable? Do you think they're stupid? And she said, absolutely not. Like, those are Americans. I would never say that about. She clearly looked at a lot of what happened in 2016 and said, I'm not doing that. And then I think Democrats say, but the centrists still feel like we're too woke and we're captured by the academic left. And like, what can we do? So what's the first answer? What do you want to see happen, John?
Sure. So I think it's really simple. What you need to do is build yourself up and not tear your competition down. That's like sales 101, right? You talk about yourself and what you're going to do to change things. And she didn't deliver a message on that. She spent too much time focusing on the old Trump is bad. We already know he's bad, but she told us more of that. She needed to build herself up. She needed to explain what her economic policies were. She needed to recognize that in America, the parents still have a voice and their voice needs to be heard at the school board meetings and heard in the districts. She needed to recognize that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the area of poverty, childhood education, shortcomings. She didn't do any of that. She didn't give a solution or even recognize that there are things that are broken. Because I think in some ways, talking about what's broken would have talked about the failures of the last 4 years and that, or the lack of progress that has been made in the last 4 years.
Okay. John, Democrats are saying, how can we not win those moderates? We changed the game plan from 2016. We learned, no?
Well, I heard the headlines, but if you read beyond the headlines, I didn't see anything that changed. I think for Harris to have positioned herself differently, she had to stand up and say, I'm 4 years smarter than I was when I ran in 2020. I know that some of the positions I took are not popular. I know that some of the things that we've done in the Biden administration haven't really worked as we hoped they would. So here, when I say I'm going to turn the page, which is a phrase that she used, here's what I mean. And she never did that, right? And I agree with John, right? Her entire campaign came down to, I'm not Trump.
So as we get ready to wrap here in a few minutes, yesterday on this program, we talked to a nonpartisan group called Unite New York, and they're looking at a number of electoral reforms, term limits, ranked choice voting, open primaries. And they were very critical of Andrew Cuomo, saying Cuomo made it harder for third parties. Cuomo made it harder to vote in a primary. I mean, all these things that have to happen that put up barriers. And New York's one of 12 states that don't allow for open primaries. As an independent, do you want to have a choice every year to say, hey, I'm going to vote in one of the two. I'm an independent, but I'm allowed to, and I'm going to choose. Do you want to see that change?
I do. I actually remember when Arnold Schwarzenegger became the governor of California against, I want to say it was something like 125 candidates, and he won a plurality of the vote or something like that. But
there's a lot of candidates.
Yeah, so maybe that's not quite as efficient as we need to be, but I'd love to see something like ranked choice voting. I'd love to see open primaries. Right now, if you want to vote in a primary, you have to register for a party.
Right.
And I've switched back and forth since I moved back to New York in 2013. I've switched back and forth between Republican and Democrat twice.
But you want to have that choice as an independent that says open primaries, change it up.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. John Love, what do you think?
Totally agree. I think that our choice is limited by the power structure in both parties right now. And when you spend $1.5 billion on election advertising, et cetera, it kind of tells you that the elite on both sides, nobody can convince me the Democrats aren't elitists and the Republicans aren't elitists. We need open primaries. We need to be able to help somebody that represents us get to the top of the ticket or into office despite not having a multi-million, $100 million budget to do so.
All right, last 90 seconds. By the way, once California finishes counting all their votes, which is who knows when, again, what are you doing out there, California? The final election tally, Trump will have just under 50%. He'll have like 49.8. Harris will have like 48.4. We're still very closely divided. This is not 2008. It's not 1984. But Republicans are feeling buoyed. And I want to give just 30 seconds apiece, just real quickly here. What are you most optimistic for going for the next 4 years? If it goes well, it looks like what?
Well, it looks like some of the economic proposals that Trump will be on a stronger economic path that will help all Americans, okay. Not just a few.
And if it goes poorly over the next 4 years?
Russia will extend itself into Western Europe. Israel will continue to battle against all odds in the Middle East without enough support. China will make a move on Taiwan, and we won't be ready.
John Love, next 4 years go well, it looks like what?
Sure. Our economy is doing better. The average American feels like they're in a better place than they were 4 years ago when the election took place, and that the center, the 80 or 90% of America, has a voice that they feel is being heard more so than it is now. I also hope that the media, in a lot of cases, becomes more neutral if at all possible, because even after the election, nobody's really admitting how it was blown. It's that still Trump is bad. And what are we going to do? And I haven't seen the elites leaving for Canada yet, but that's what they all threatened.
Those that haven't shaved their heads.
Yes.
And 10 seconds. What concern, if it doesn't go well in the next 4 years?
Russia and China, big problems.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to thank our guests, John Love, John Kalia, coming in to tell us about their views as, they don't represent all the independents. They can't. They're just two people. But the independents in this country, according to Gallup, biggest number it's ever been, 43%. Democratic Party, the lowest it's ever been, 27% self-ID, 27% self-ID Republicans. It's a big change, and we're going to keep listening to people like John Love, president of the Bob Johnson Auto Group. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Emma.
John Kalia, executive coach and author. You can find his book still. It's The Awakening of Artemis, which reached number 6 on Amazon Sci-Fi Adventures bestseller list. Congratulations for that,
Thank
by
you.
The way. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
More connections coming up in just a moment.